and then authority will probably shift from humans to computers. My illusion of free will is likely to disintegrate, as I daily encounter institutions, corporations, and government agencies that understand and manipulate what was until now my inaccessible inner realm. This is already happening in the field of medicine. The most important medical decisions in our lives rely not on our feelings of illness or wellness, or even on the informed predictions of our doctor, but on the calculations of computers that understand our bodies much better than we do. Within a few decades, big data algorithms, informed by a constant stream of biometric data, could monitor our health 24/7. They might be able to detect the very beginning of influenza, cancer, or Alzheimer's disease, long before we feel anything is wrong with us. They could then recommend appropriate treatments, diets, and daily regimens, custom-built for our unique physique, DNA, and personality. People will enjoy the best healthcare in history, but for precisely this reason, they will probably be sick all the time. There is always something wrong somewhere in the body. There is always something that can be improved. In the past, you felt perfectly healthy as long as you didn't sense pain and you didn't manifest an apparent disability by, say, limping. But by 2050, thanks to biometric sensors and big data algorithms, diseases may be diagnosed and treated long before they lead to pain or disability. As a result, you will always find yourself suffering from some medical condition and following this or that algorithmic recommendation. If you refuse, perhaps your medical insurance will become invalid, or your boss will fire you. Why should they pay the price of your obstinacy? It is one thing to continue smoking, despite general statistics that connect smoking with lung cancer. It is a very different thing to continue smoking despite a concrete warning from a biometric sensor that has just detected 17 cancerous cells in your upper left lung. And if you are willing to defy the sensor, what will you do when the sensor forwards the warning to your insurance agency, your manager, and your mother? Who will have the time and energy to deal with all these illnesses? In all likelihood, we could just instruct our health algorithm to deal with most of these problems as it sees fit. At most, it will send periodic updates to our smartphones, telling us that 17 cancerous cells were detected and destroyed. Hypochondriacs might dutifully read these updates, but most of us will ignore them, just as we ignore those annoying antivirus notices on our computers. The drama of decision-making. What is already beginning to happen in medicine is likely to occur in more and more fields. The key invention is the biometric sensor, which people can wear on or inside their bodies, and which converts biological processes into electronic information that computers can store and analyze. Given enough biometric data and enough computing power, external data processing systems can hack all your desires, decisions, and opinions. They can know exactly who you are. Most people don't know themselves very well. When I was 21, I finally realized that I was gay, after several years of living in denial. That's hardly exceptional. Many gay men spend their entire teenage years unsure about their sexuality. Now imagine the situation in 2050, when an algorithm can tell any teenager exactly where he is on the gay-straight spectrum, and even how malleable that position is. Perhaps the algorithm will show you pictures or videos of attractive men and women, track your eye movements, blood pressure, and brain activity, and within 5 minutes display a number on the Kinsey scale. Such an invention could have saved me years of frustration. Perhaps you personally wouldn't want to take such a test, but then maybe you'll find yourself with a group of friends at Michelle's boring birthday party, and somebody suggests that you all take turns checking yourself on this cool new algorithm, with everybody standing around to watch the results and comment on them. Would you just walk away? Even if you do, and even if you keep hiding from yourself and your classmates, you won't be able to hide from Amazon, Alibaba, or the secret police. As you surf the web, watch YouTube, or read your social media feed, the algorithms will discreetly monitor you, analyze you, and tell Coca-Cola that if it wants to sell you some fizzy drink, it had better use the advertisement with the shirtless guy rather than the shirtless girl. You won't even know. But they will know, and such information will be worth billions. Then again, maybe people will share their information willingly in order to get better recommendations, and eventually in order to get the algorithm to make decisions for them. It starts with simple things, like sitting down with friends to spend a cozy evening in front of the TV. 50 years ago, you had very little choice about what you could watch, but today, with the rise of view-on-demand services, there are thousands of titles available. Reaching an agreement can be quite difficult, because while you like science fiction thrillers, Jack prefers romantic comedies, and Jill votes for artsy French films. You may well end up compromising on some mediocre B-movie that disappoints all of you. An algorithm might help. You can tell it which previous movies each of you really liked, and, based on its massive statistical database, the algorithm can then find the perfect match for the group. Unfortunately, such a crude algorithm is easily misled, particularly because self-reporting is a notoriously unreliable gauge for people's true preferences. It often happens that when we hear lots of people praise some movie as a masterpiece, we feel compelled to watch it, and even though we might fall asleep midway through, we don't want to look like Philistines, so we tell everyone it was an amazing experience. Such problems, however, can be solved if we just allow the algorithm to collect real-time data on us as we actually watch movies, instead of relying on our own dubious self-reports. For starters, the algorithm can monitor which movies we completed and which we stopped watching halfway through. Even if we tell the whole world that Gone with the Wind is the best movie ever made, the algorithm will know that we never made it past the first half hour and never saw Atlanta burning. Yet the algorithm can go much deeper than that. Engineers are currently developing software that can detect human emotions based on the movements of our eyes and facial muscles. Add a good camera to the television, and such software will know which scenes made us laugh, which scenes made us sad, and which scenes bored us. Next, connect the algorithm to biometric sensors, and the algorithm will know how each frame influenced our heart rate, our blood pressure, and our brain activity. As we watch, say, Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, the algorithm might note that the rape scene caused us an almost imperceptible tinge of sexual arousal, that when Vincent accidentally shot Marvin in the face, it made us laugh guiltily, and that we didn't get the joke about the big kahuna burger, but we laughed anyway so that we wouldn't look stupid. When you force yourself to laugh, you use different brain circuits and muscles than when you laugh because something is really funny. Humans cannot usually detect the difference, but a biometric sensor could. The word television comes from Greek tele, which means far, and Latin visio, sight. It was originally conceived as a device that would allow us to see from afar. But soon it might allow us also to be seen from afar. As George Orwell envisioned in 1984, the television might watch us while we are watching it. After we've finished watching Tarantino's entire filmography, we may have forgotten most of it. But Netflix, or Amazon, or whoever owns the TV algorithm, will know our personality type and how to press our emotional buttons. Such data could enable Netflix and Amazon to choose movies for us with uncanny precision, but it could also enable them to make the most important decisions in life for us, such as what to study, where to work, and whom to marry. Of course, Amazon won't be correct all the time. That's impossible. Algorithms will repeatedly make mistakes due to insufficient data, faulty programming, muddled goal definitions, and the chaotic nature of life. But Amazon won't have to be perfect. It will just need to be better on average than us humans. And that is not so difficult, because most people don't know themselves very well, and most people often make terrible mistakes in the most important decisions of their lives. Even more than algorithms, humans suffer from insufficient data, from faulty programming, genetic and cultural, from muddled definitions, and from the chaos of life. You may well list the many problems that beset algorithms and conclude that people will never trust them. But this is a bit like cataloguing all the drawbacks of democracy and concluding that no sane person would ever choose to support such a system. Winston Churchill famously said that democracy is the worst political system in the world, except for all the others. Rightly or wrongly, people might reach the same conclusions about big data algorithms. They have lots of glitches, but we have no better alternative. As scientists gain a deeper understanding of the way humans make decisions, the temptation to rely on algorithms is likely to increase. Hacking human decision-making not only will make big data algorithms more reliable, but also will simultaneously make human feelings less reliable. As governments and corporations succeed in hacking the human operating system, we will be exposed to a barrage of precision-guided manipulation, advertisements, and propaganda. It might become so easy to manipulate our opinions and emotions that we will be forced to rely on algorithms in the same way that a pilot suffering an attack of vertigo must ignore what his own senses are telling him and put all his trust in the machinery. In some countries and in some situations, people might not be given any choice, and they will be forced to obey the decisions of big data algorithms. Yet even in allegedly free societies, algorithms might gain authority because we will learn from experience to trust them on more and more issues, and we will gradually lose our ability to make decisions for ourselves. Just think of the way that within a mere 2 decades, billions of people have come to entrust the Google search algorithm with one of the most important tasks of all, searching for relevant and trustworthy information. We no longer search for information. Instead, we Google. And as we increasingly rely on Google for answers, so our ability to search for information by ourselves diminishes. Already today, truth is defined by the top results of the Google search. This has also been happening with physical abilities, such as navigating space. People ask Google to guide them around. When they reach an intersection, their gut feeling might tell them, turn left. But Google Maps says, turn right. At first, they listen to their gut feeling, turn left, get stuck in a traffic jam, and miss an important meeting. Next time they listen to Google, turn right, and make it on time. They learn from experience to trust Google. Within a year or two, they blindly rely on whatever Google Maps tells them, and if their smartphone fails, they are completely clueless. In March 2012, 3 Japanese tourists in Australia decided to take a day trip to a small offshore island and drove their car straight into the Pacific Ocean. The driver, 21-year-old Yuzu Nuda, later said that she just followed the instructions of the GPS and it told us we could drive down there. It kept saying it would navigate us to a road. We got stuck. In several similar incidents, people drove into a lake or fell off a demolished bridge by following GPS instructions. The ability to navigate is like a muscle. Use it or lose it. The same is true for the ability to choose spouses or professions. Every year, millions of youngsters need to decide what to study in college. This is a very important and difficult decision. You are under pressure from your parents, your friends, and your teachers, who have different interests and opinions. You also have your own fears and fantasies to deal with. Your judgment is clouded and manipulated by Hollywood blockbusters, trashy novels, and sophisticated advertising campaigns. It is particularly difficult to make a wise decision because you do not really know what it takes to succeed in different professions, and you don't necessarily have a realistic image of your own strengths and weaknesses. What does it take to succeed as a lawyer? How do I perform under pressure? Am I a good team worker? One student might start law school because she has an inaccurate understanding of her own skills and an even more distorted view of what being a lawyer actually involves. You don't get to give dramatic speeches and shout, "Objection, Your Honor," all day. Meanwhile, her friend decides to fulfill a childhood dream and study professional ballet, even though she doesn't have the necessary bone structure or discipline. Years later, both deeply regret their choices. In the future, we will be able to rely on Google to make such decisions for us. Google could tell me that I would be wasting my time in law or ballet school, but that I might make an excellent and very happy psychologist or plumber. Once AI makes better decisions than we do about careers and perhaps even relationships, our concept of humanity and of life will have to change. Humans are used to thinking about life as a drama of decision-making. Liberal democracy and free market capitalism see the individual as an autonomous agent, constantly making choices about the world. Works of art, be they Shakespeare plays, Jane Austen novels, or tacky Hollywood comedies, usually revolve around the hero having to make some particularly crucial decision. To be or not to be. To listen to my wife and kill King Duncan, or listen to my conscience and spare him. To marry Mr. Collins or Mr. Darcy. Christian and Muslim theology similarly focus on the drama of decision-making, arguing that everlasting salvation depends on making the right choice. What will happen to this view of life as we increasingly rely on AI to make decisions for us? At present, we trust Netflix to recommend movies and Google Maps to choose whether we turn right or left. But once we begin to count on AI to decide what to study, where to work, and whom to marry, human life will cease to be a drama of decision-making. Democratic elections and free markets will make little sense. So would most religions and works of art. Imagine Anna Karenina taking out her smartphone and asking the Facebook algorithm whether she should stay married to Karenin or elope with the dashing Count Vronsky. Or imagine your favorite Shakespeare play, with all the crucial decisions made by the Google algorithm. Hamlet and Macbeth will have much more comfortable lives, but what kind of lives will those be? Do we have models for making sense of such lives? As authority shifts from humans to algorithms, we may no longer view the world as the playground of autonomous individuals struggling to make the right choices. Instead, we might perceive the entire universe as a flow of data, see organisms as little more than biochemical algorithms, and believe that humanity's cosmic vocation is to create an all-encompassing data processing system and then merge into it. Already today, we are becoming tiny chips inside a giant data processing system that nobody really understands. Every day I absorb countless data bits through emails, tweets, and articles, process the data, and transmit back new bits through more emails, tweets, and articles. I don't really know where I fit into the great scheme of things, or how my bits of data connect with the bits produced by billions of other humans and computers. I don't have time to find out, because I am too busy answering all these emails. The philosophical car. People might argue that algorithms will never make important decisions for us, because important decisions usually involve an ethical dimension, and algorithms don't understand ethics. Yet there is no reason to assume that algorithms won't be able to outperform the average human, even in ethics. Today, as devices such as smartphones and autonomous vehicles undertake decisions that used to be a human monopoly, their creators are already starting to grapple with the same kinds of ethical problems that have bedeviled humans for millennia. For example, suppose two kids chasing a ball jump right in front of a self-driving car. Based on its lightning calculations, the algorithm driving the car concludes that the only way to avoid hitting the two kids is to swerve into the opposite lane and risk colliding with an oncoming truck. The algorithm calculates that in such a case, there is a 70% chance that the owner of the car, who is fast asleep in the back seat, will be killed. What should the algorithm do? Philosophers have been arguing about such trolley problems for millennia. They are so called because the textbook examples in modern philosophical debates refer to a runaway trolley car racing down a track rather than to a self-driving car. Up till now, these arguments have had embarrassingly little impact on actual behavior, because in times of crisis, humans all too often forget about their philosophical views and follow their emotions and gut instincts instead. One of the nastiest experiments in the history of the social sciences was conducted in December 1970 on a group of students at the Princeton Theological Seminary who were training to become ministers in the Presbyterian Church. Each student was asked to hurry to a distant lecture hall to give a talk on the Good Samaritan parable, which tells how a Jew traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho was robbed and beaten by criminals, who then left him to die by the side of the road. After some time, a priest and a Levite walk by, but both ignore the man. In contrast, a Samaritan, a member of a sect much despised by the Jews, stops when he sees the victim, takes care of him, and saves his life. The moral of the parable is that people's merit should be judged by their actual behavior rather than by their religious affiliation and philosophical views. The eager young seminarians rushed to the lecture hall, contemplating on the way how best to explain the moral of the parable. But the experimenters planted in their path a shabbily dressed person who was sitting slumped in a doorway with his head down and his eyes closed. As each unsuspecting seminarian hurried past, the victim coughed and groaned pitifully. Most seminarians did not even stop to inquire what was wrong with the man, let alone offer any help. The emotional stress created by the need to hurry to the lecture hall trumped their moral obligation to help strangers in distress. Human emotions trump philosophical theories in countless other situations. This makes the ethical and philosophical history of the world a rather depressing tale of wonderful ideals and less than ideal behavior. How many Christians actually turn the other cheek? How many Buddhists actually rise above egoistic obsessions? And how many Jews actually love their neighbors as themselves? That's just the way natural selection has shaped Homo sapiens. Like all mammals, Homo sapiens uses emotions to quickly make life and death decisions. We have inherited our anger, our fear, and our lust from millions of ancestors, all of whom passed the most rigorous quality control tests of natural selection. Unfortunately, what was good for survival and reproduction in the African savanna a million years ago does not necessarily make for responsible behavior on 21st century motorways. Distracted, angry, and anxious human drivers kill more than a million people in traffic accidents every year. We can send all our philosophers, prophets, and priests to preach ethics to these drivers, but on the road, mammalian emotions and savanna instincts will still take over. Consequently, seminarians in a rush will ignore people in distress, and drivers in a crisis will run over hapless pedestrians. This disjunction between the seminary and the road is one of the biggest practical problems in ethics. Immanuel Kant, John Stuart Mill, and John Rawls can sit in some cozy university hall and discuss theoretical ethical problems for days. But would their conclusions actually be implemented by stressed-out drivers caught in a split-second emergency? Perhaps Michael Schumacher, the Formula One champion who is sometimes hailed as the best driver in history, had the ability to think about philosophy while racing a car, but most of us aren't Schumacher. Computer algorithms, however, have not been shaped by natural selection, and they have neither emotions nor gut instincts. Therefore, in moments of crisis, they could follow ethical guidelines much better than humans, provided we find a way to code ethics in precise numbers and statistics. If we could teach Kant, Mill, and Rawls to write code, they would be able to program the self-driving car in their cozy laboratory and be certain that the car would follow their commandments on the highway. In effect, every car would be driven by Michael Schumacher and Immanuel Kant, rolled into one. If you program a self-driving car to stop and help strangers in distress, it will do so come hell or high water, unless, of course, you insert an exception clause for infernal or high water scenarios. Similarly, if your self-driving car is programmed to swerve into the opposite lane in order to save the two kids in its path, you can bet your life this is exactly what it will do. Which means that when designing their self-driving car, Toyota or Tesla will be transforming a theoretical problem in the philosophy of ethics into a practical problem of engineering. Granted, the philosophical algorithms will never be perfect. Mistakes will still happen, resulting in injuries, deaths, and extremely complicated lawsuits. For the first time in history, you might be able to sue a philosopher for the unfortunate results of his or her theories, because for the first time in history, you might be able to prove a direct causal link between philosophical ideas and real-life events. However, in order to take over from human drivers, the algorithms won't have to be perfect. They will just have to be better than the humans. Given that human drivers kill more than 1 million people each year, that isn't such a tall order. When all is said and done, would you rather the car next to you was being driven by a drunk teenager or by the Schumacher-Kant team? The same logic is true, not just of driving, but of many other situations as well. Take, for example, job applications. In the 21st century, the decision whether to hire somebody for a job will increasingly be made by algorithms. We cannot rely on the machine to set the relevant ethical standards. Humans will still need to do that. But once we decide on an ethical standard in the job market, that it is wrong to discriminate against blacks or against women, for example, we can rely on machines to implement and maintain this standard better than humans. A human manager may know and even agree that it is unethical to discriminate against blacks and women. But then, when a black woman applies for a job, the manager subconsciously discriminates against her and decides not to hire her. If we allow a computer to evaluate job applications and program the computer to completely ignore race and gender, we can be certain that the computer will indeed ignore these factors because computers don't have a subconscious. Of course, it won't be easy to write code for evaluating job applications, and there is always a danger that the engineers will somehow program their own subconscious biases into the software. Yet, once we discover such mistakes, it would probably be far easier to debug the software than to rid humans of their racist and misogynist biases. We saw that the rise of artificial intelligence might push most humans out of the job market, including drivers and traffic police, since when rowdy humans are replaced by obedient algorithms, traffic police will be redundant. However, there might be some new openings for philosophers, because their skills, until now devoid of much market value, will suddenly be in very high demand. So if you want to study something that will guarantee a good job in the future, maybe philosophy is not such a bad gamble. Of course, philosophers seldom agree on the right course of action. Few trolley problems have been solved to the satisfaction of all philosophers, and consequentialist thinkers such as John Stuart Mill, who judge actions by consequences, hold quite different opinions from deontologists such as Immanuel Kant, who judge actions by absolute rules. Would Tesla have to actually take a stance on such knotty matters in order to produce a car? Well, maybe Tesla will just leave it to the market. Tesla could produce two models of the self-driving car, the Tesla altruist and the Tesla egoist. In an emergency, the altruist sacrifices its owner to the greater good, whereas the egoist does everything in its power to save its owner, even if it means killing the two kids. Customers will then be able to buy the car that best fits their favorite philosophical view. If more people buy the Tesla egoist, you won't be able to blame Tesla for that. After all, the customer is always right. This is not a joke. In a pioneering 2015 study, people were presented with a hypothetical scenario of a self-driving car about to run over several pedestrians. Most said that in such a case, the car should save the pedestrians, even at the price of killing its owner. When they were then asked whether they personally would buy a car programmed to sacrifice its owner for the greater good, most said no. For themselves, they would prefer the Tesla egoist. Imagine this situation. You have bought a new car, but before you can start using it, you must open the settings menu and check one of several boxes. In case of an accident, do you want the car to sacrifice your life or to kill the family in the other vehicle? Is this a choice you even want to make? Just think of the arguments you are going to have with your husband about which box to check. So maybe the state should intervene to regulate the market and lay down an ethical code binding all self-driving cars. Some lawmakers will doubtless be thrilled by the opportunity to finally make laws that are always followed to the letter. Others may be alarmed by such unprecedented and totalitarian responsibility. After all, throughout history, the limitations of actually enforcing laws provided a welcome check on the biases, mistakes, and excesses of lawmakers. It was an extremely lucky thing that laws against homosexuality and blasphemy were only partially enforced. Do we really want a system in which the decisions of fallible politicians become as inexorable as gravity? Digital dictatorships. AI often frightens people because they don't trust the AI to remain obedient. We have seen too many science fiction movies about robots rebelling against their human masters, running amok in the streets and slaughtering everyone. Yet the real problem with robots is exactly the opposite. We should fear them because they will probably always obey their masters and never rebel. There is nothing wrong with blind obedience, of course, as long as the robots happen to serve benign masters. Even in warfare, reliance on killer robots could ensure that for the first time in history, the laws of war would actually be obeyed on the battlefield. Human soldiers are sometimes driven by their emotions to murder, pillage, and rape in violation of the laws of war. We usually associate emotions with compassion, love, and empathy. But in wartime, the emotions that take control are all too often fear, hatred, and cruelty. Since robots have no emotions, they could be trusted to always adhere to the dry letter of the military code and never be swayed by personal fears and hatreds. On March the 16th, 1968, a company of American soldiers went berserk in the South Vietnamese village of My Lai and massacred about 400 civilians. This war crime resulted from the local initiative of men who had been involved in jungle guerrilla warfare for several months. It did not serve any strategic purpose and contravened both U.S. legal code and military policy. It was the fault of human emotions. If the United States had deployed killer robots in Vietnam, the massacre at My Lai never would have occurred. Nevertheless, before we rush to develop and deploy killer robots, we need to remind ourselves that the robots always reflect and amplify the qualities of their code. If the code is restrained and benign, the robots will probably be a huge improvement over the average human soldier. Yet if the code is ruthless and cruel, the results will be catastrophic. The real problem with robots is not their own artificial intelligence, but rather the natural stupidity and cruelty of their human masters. In July 1995, Bosnian Serb troops massacred more than 8,000 Muslim Bosniaks around the town of Srebrenica. Unlike the haphazard My Lai massacre, the Srebrenica killings were a protracted and well-organized operation that reflected Bosnian Serb policy to ethnically cleanse Bosnia of Muslims. If the Bosnian Serbs had had killer robots in 1995, it would likely have made the atrocity worse rather than better. Not one robot would have had a moment's hesitation carrying out whatever orders it received, and none would have spared the life of a single Muslim child due to feelings of compassion, disgust, or mere lethargy. A ruthless dictator armed with such killer robots will never have to fear that his soldiers will turn against him, no matter how heartless or crazy his orders. A robot army would probably have strangled the French Revolution in its cradle in 1789, and if in 2011 Hosni Mubarak had had a contingent of killer robots, he could have unleashed them on the populace without fear of defection. Similarly, an imperialist government relying on a robot army could wage unpopular wars without any concern that its robots might lose their motivation or that their families might stage protests. If the United States had had killer robots in the Vietnam War, the My Lai massacre might have been prevented, but the war itself could have dragged on for many more years because the American government would have had fewer worries about demoralized soldiers, massive anti-war demonstrations, or a movement of veteran robots against the war. Some American citizens might still have objected to the war, but without the fear of being drafted themselves, the memory of personally committing atrocities, or the painful loss of a dear relative, the protesters probably would have been both less numerous and less committed. These kinds of problems are far less relevant to autonomous civilian vehicles, since no car manufacturer would maliciously program its vehicles to target and kill people. Yet, autonomous weapon systems are a catastrophe waiting to happen, because too many governments tend to be ethically corrupt, if not downright evil. The danger is not restricted to killing machines. Surveillance systems could be equally risky. In the hands of a benign government, powerful surveillance algorithms could be the best thing that ever happened to humankind. Yet the same big data algorithms might also empower a future Big Brother, so we might end up with an Orwellian surveillance regime in which all individuals are monitored all the time. In fact, we might end up with something that even Orwell could barely imagine. A total surveillance regime that follows not just all our external activities and utterances, but can even go under our skin to observe our inner experiences. Consider, for example, what the Kim regime in North Korea might do with the new technology. In the future, each North Korean citizen might be required to wear a biometric bracelet that monitors everything that person does and says, as well as their blood pressure and brain activity. By using our growing understanding of the human brain, and drawing on the immense powers of machine learning, the North Korean regime might be able, for the first time in history, to gauge what each and every citizen is thinking at each and every moment. If a North Korean looks at a picture of Kim Jong-un, and the biometric sensors pick up the telltale signs of anger, higher blood pressure, increased activity in the amygdala, that person will be in the gulag tomorrow morning. Granted, due to its isolation, the North Korean regime might have difficulty developing the required technology by itself. However, the technology might be pioneered in more tech-savvy nations and copied or bought by the North Koreans and other backward dictatorships. Both China and Russia are constantly improving their surveillance tools, as are a number of democratic countries, ranging from the United States to my home country, Israel. Nicknamed the Startup Nation, Israel has an extremely vibrant high-tech sector and a cutting-edge cybersecurity industry. At the same time, it is also locked in a deadly conflict with the Palestinians, and at least some of its leaders, generals, and citizens might well be happy to create a total surveillance regime in the West Bank as soon as they have the necessary technology. Already today, whenever Palestinians make a phone call, post something on Facebook, or travel from one city to another, they are likely to be monitored by Israeli microphones, cameras, drones, or spy software. The gathered data is then analyzed with the aid of big data algorithms. This helps the Israeli security forces to pinpoint and neutralize potential threats without having to place too many boots on the ground. The Palestinians may administer some towns and villages in the West Bank, but the Israelis control the sky, the airwaves, and cyberspace. It therefore takes surprisingly few Israeli soldiers to effectively control about 2.5 million Palestinians in the West Bank. In one tragicomic incident in October 2017, a Palestinian laborer posted to his private Facebook account a picture of himself in his workplace, alongside a bulldozer. Adjacent to the image, he wrote, "Good morning." An automated algorithm made a small error when transliterating the Arabic letters. Instead of Asabechum, which means good morning, the algorithm identified the letters as Udbechum, which means kill them. Suspecting that the man might be a terrorist intending to use a bulldozer to run people over, Israeli security forces swiftly arrested him. He was released after they realized that the algorithm made a mistake. But the offending Facebook post was nevertheless taken down. You can never be too careful. What Palestinians are experiencing today in the West Bank might be just a primitive preview of what billions will eventually experience all over the planet. In the late 20th century, democracies usually outperformed dictatorships because democracies were better at data processing. A democracy diffuses the power to process information and make decisions among many people and institutions, whereas a dictatorship concentrates information and power in one place. Given 20th century technology, it was inefficient to concentrate too much information and power in one place. Nobody had the ability to process all the information fast enough and make the right decisions. This is part of the reason the Soviet Union made far worse decisions than the United States, and why the Soviet economy lagged far behind the American economy. However, soon AI might swing the pendulum in the opposite direction. AI makes it possible to process enormous amounts of information centrally. In fact, AI might make centralized systems far more efficient than diffused systems, because machine learning works better the more information it can analyze. If you disregard all privacy concerns and concentrate all the information relating to a billion people in one database, you can train much better algorithms than if you respect individual privacy and have in your database only partial information on a million people. For example, if an authoritarian government orders all its citizens to have their DNA scanned and to share all their medical data with some central authority, it would gain an immense advantage in genetics and medical research over societies in which medical data is strictly private. The main handicap of authoritarian regimes in the 20th century, the attempt to concentrate all information in one place, might become their decisive advantage in the 21st century. As algorithms come to know us so well, authoritarian governments could gain absolute control over their citizens, even more so than in Nazi Germany, and resistance to such regimes might be utterly impossible. Not only will the regime know exactly how you feel, but it could make you feel whatever it wants. The dictator might not be able to provide citizens with health care or equality, but he could make them love him and hate his opponents. Democracy in its present form cannot survive the merger of biotech and infotech. Either democracy will successfully reinvent itself in a radically new form, or humans will come to live in digital dictatorships. This will not be a return to the days of Hitler and Stalin. Digital dictatorships will be as different from Nazi Germany as Nazi Germany was different from Ancien Régime France. Louis XIV was a centralizing autocrat, but he did not have the technology to build a modern totalitarian state. He suffered no opposition to his rule, yet in the absence of radios, telephones, and trains, he had little control over the day-to-day lives of peasants in remote Breton villages, or even of townspeople in the heart of Paris. He had neither the will nor the ability to establish a mass party, a countrywide youth movement, or a national education system. It was the new technologies of the 20th century that gave Hitler both the motivation and the power to do such things. We cannot predict the motivations and powers of digital dictatorships in 2084, but it is very unlikely that they will just copy Hitler and Stalin. Those gearing themselves up to refight the battles of the 1930s might be caught off guard by an attack from a totally different direction. Even if democracy manages to adapt and survive, people might become the victims of new kinds of oppression and discrimination. Today, more and more banks, corporations, and institutions are already using algorithms to analyze data and make decisions about us. For example, when you apply to your bank for a loan, it is likely that your application will be processed by an algorithm rather than by a human being. The algorithm analyzes lots of data about you and statistics about millions of other people, and decides whether you are reliable enough to receive a loan. Often the algorithm does a better job than a human banker. But the problem is that if the algorithm discriminates against some people unjustly, it is difficult to know that. If the bank refuses to give you a loan, and you ask why, the bank replies, "The algorithm said no." You ask, "Why did the algorithm say no? What's wrong with me?" And the bank replies, "We don't know." No human understands this algorithm, because it is based on advanced machine learning. But we trust our algorithm, so we won't give you a loan. When discrimination is directed against entire groups, such as women or blacks, these groups can organize and protest against their collective discrimination. But now an algorithm might discriminate against you personally, and you will have no idea why. Maybe the algorithm will find something in your DNA, your personal history, or your Facebook account that it does not like. The algorithm discriminates against you not because you are a woman or an African American, but because you are you. You don't know the exact reasons, and even if you knew, you would not be able to organize a protest with other people, because there are no other people suffering the exact same prejudice. Instead of just collective discrimination, in the 21st century we might face a growing problem of individual discrimination. At the highest levels of authority, we will probably retain human figureheads, who will give us the illusion that the algorithms are only advisers, and that ultimate authority is still in human hands. We will not appoint an AI to be the Chancellor of Germany or the CEO of Google. However, the decisions taken by the Chancellor and the CEO will be shaped by AI. The Chancellor could still choose between several different options, but all those options will be the outcome of big data analysis, and they will reflect the way AI views the world more than the way humans view it. To take an analogous example, today, politicians all over the world can choose between several different economic policies. But in almost all cases, the various policies on offer reflect a capitalist outlook on economics. The politicians have an illusion of choice, but the really important decisions have already been made much earlier by the economists, bankers, and business people who shaped the different options on the menu. Within a couple of decades, politicians might find themselves choosing from a menu written by AI. Artificial intelligence and natural stupidity. One piece of good news is that at least for the next few decades, we won't have to deal with the full-blown science fiction nightmare of AI gaining consciousness and deciding to enslave or wipe out humanity. We will increasingly rely on algorithms to make decisions for us, but it is unlikely that the algorithms will start to consciously manipulate us. They won't have any consciousness. Science fiction tends to confuse intelligence with consciousness and assume that in order to match or surpass human intelligence, computers will have to develop consciousness. The basic plot of almost all movies and novels about AI revolves around the magical moment when a computer or a robot gains consciousness. Once that happens, either the human hero falls in love with the robot, or the robot tries to kill all the humans. Sometimes both things happen simultaneously. But in reality, there is no reason to assume that artificial intelligence will gain consciousness, because intelligence and consciousness are very different things. Intelligence is the ability to solve problems. Consciousness is the ability to feel things such as pain, joy, love, and anger. We tend to confuse the two because in humans and other mammals, intelligence goes hand in hand with consciousness. Mammals solve most problems by feeling things. Computers, however, solve problems in a very different way. There are several different paths leading to high intelligence, and only some of these paths involve gaining consciousness. Just as airplanes fly faster than birds without ever developing feathers, so computers may come to solve problems much better than mammals without ever developing feelings. True, AI will have to analyze human feelings accurately in order to treat human illnesses, identify human terrorists, recommend human mates, and navigate a street full of human pedestrians. But it could do so without having any feelings of its own. An algorithm does not need to feel joy, anger, or fear in order to recognize the different biochemical patterns of joyful, angry, or frightened apes. Of course, it is not absolutely impossible that AI will develop feelings of its own. We still don't know enough about consciousness to be sure. In general, there are three possibilities we need to consider. One, consciousness is somehow linked to organic biochemistry in such a way that it will never be possible to create consciousness in non-organic systems. Two, consciousness is not linked to organic biochemistry, but it is linked to intelligence in such a way that computers could develop consciousness, and computers will have to develop consciousness if they are to pass a certain threshold of intelligence. Three, there are no essential links between consciousness and either organic biochemistry or high intelligence. Therefore, computers might develop consciousness, but not necessarily. They could become super intelligent while still having zero consciousness. With our present state of knowledge, we cannot rule out any of these options. Yet, precisely because we know so little about consciousness, it seems unlikely that we could program conscious computers anytime soon. Therefore, despite the immense power of artificial intelligence, for the foreseeable future its usage will continue to depend, to some extent, on human consciousness. The danger is that if we invest too much in developing AI and too little in developing human consciousness, the very sophisticated artificial intelligence of computers might only serve to empower the natural stupidity of humans. We are unlikely to face a robot rebellion in the coming decades, but we might have to deal with hordes of bots that know how to press our emotional buttons better than our mother does, and that use this uncanny ability to try to sell us something, be it a car, a politician, or an entire ideology. The bots could identify our deepest fears, hatreds, and cravings, and use these inner leverages against us. We have already been given a foretaste of this in recent elections and referendums across the world, when hackers learned how to manipulate individual voters by analyzing data about them and exploiting their existing prejudices. While science fiction thrillers are drawn to dramatic apocalypses of fire and smoke, in reality, we might be facing a banal apocalypse by clicking. To avoid such outcomes, for every dollar and every minute we invest in improving artificial intelligence, it would be wise to invest a dollar and a minute in advancing human consciousness. Unfortunately, at present, we are not doing much in the way of research into human consciousness and ways to develop it. We are researching and developing human abilities mainly according to the immediate needs of the economic and political system, rather than according to our own long-term needs as conscious beings. My boss wants me to answer emails as quickly as possible, but he has little interest in my ability to taste and appreciate the food I'm eating. Consequently, I check my emails even during meals, which means I lose the ability to pay attention to my own sensations. The economic system pressures me to expand and diversify my investment portfolio, but it gives me zero incentive to expand and diversify my compassion. So I strive to understand the mysteries of the stock exchange while making far less effort to understand the deep causes of suffering. In this, humans are similar to other domesticated animals. We have bred docile cows that produce enormous amounts of milk, but are otherwise far inferior to their wild ancestors. They are less agile, less curious, and less resourceful. We are now creating tame humans that produce enormous amounts of data and function as very efficient chips in a huge data processing mechanism, but these data cows hardly maximize the human potential. Indeed, we have no idea what our full human potential is, because we know so little about the human mind. And yet we don't invest much in exploring the human mind, instead focusing on increasing the speed of our internet connections and the efficiency of our big data algorithms. If we are not careful, we will end up with downgraded humans misusing upgraded computers to wreak havoc on themselves and on the world. Digital dictatorships are not the only danger awaiting us. Alongside liberty, the liberal order has also set great store in the value of equality. Liberalism has always cherished political equality, and it gradually came to realize that economic equality is almost as important. For without a social safety net and a modicum of economic equality, liberty is meaningless. But just as big data algorithms might extinguish liberty, they might simultaneously create the most unequal societies that ever existed. All wealth and power might be concentrated in the hands of a tiny elite, while most people will suffer not from exploitation, but from something far worse, irrelevance. 4. Equality. Those who own the data own the future. For the last few decades, people all over the world were told that humankind is on the path to equality, and that globalization and new technologies will help us get there sooner. In reality, the 21st century might create the most unequal societies in history. Though globalization and the internet bridge the gap between countries, they threaten to enlarge the rift between classes. And just as humankind seems about to achieve global unification, the species itself might divide into different biological castes. Inequality goes back to the Stone Age. 30,000 years ago, hunter-gatherer bands buried some members in sumptuous graves replete with thousands of ivory beads, bracelets, jewels, and art objects, while other members had to settle for a bare hole in the ground. Nevertheless, ancient hunter-gatherer bands were still more egalitarian than any subsequent human society because they had very little property. Property is a prerequisite for long-term inequality. Following the agricultural revolution, property multiplied, and with it, inequality. As humans gained ownership of land, animals, plants, and tools, rigid hierarchical societies emerged, in which small elites monopolized most wealth and power for generation after generation. Humans came to accept this arrangement as natural and even divinely ordained. Hierarchy was not just the norm, but also the ideal. How could there be order without a clear hierarchy between aristocrats and commoners, between men and women, or between parents and children? Priests, philosophers, and poets all over the world patiently explained that just as in the human body not all members are equal, the feet must obey the head, so also in human society equality would bring nothing but chaos. In the late modern era, however, equality became an ideal in almost all human societies. This was partly due to the rise of the new ideologies of communism and liberalism. But it was also due to the Industrial Revolution, which made the masses more important than ever before. Industrial economies relied on masses of common workers, while industrial armies relied on masses of common soldiers. Governments in both democracies and dictatorships invested heavily in the health, education, and welfare of the masses because they needed millions of healthy laborers to operate the production lines and millions of loyal soldiers to fight in the trenches. Consequently, the history of the 20th century revolved to a large extent around the reduction of inequality between classes, races, and genders. Though the world of the year 2000 still had its share of hierarchies, it was nevertheless a far more equal place than the world of 1900. In the first years of the 21st century, people expected that the egalitarian process would continue and even accelerate. In particular, they hoped that globalization would spread economic prosperity throughout the world, and that, as a result, people in India and Egypt would come to enjoy the same opportunities and privileges as people in Finland and Canada. An entire generation grew up on this promise. Now it seems that this promise might not be fulfilled. Globalization has certainly benefited large segments of humanity, but there are signs of growing inequality both between and within societies. Some groups increasingly monopolize the fruits of globalization, while billions are left behind. Today, the richest 1% own half the world's wealth. Even more alarmingly, the richest 100 people together own more than the poorest 4 billion. This situation could get far worse. As explained in earlier chapters, the rise of AI might eliminate the economic value and political power of most humans. At the same time, improvements in biotechnology might make it possible to translate economic inequality into biological inequality. The super-rich will finally have something really worthwhile to do with their stupendous wealth. While up until now they have only been able to buy little more than status symbols, soon they might be able to buy life itself. If new treatments for extending life and upgrading physical and cognitive abilities prove to be expensive, humankind might split into biological castes. Throughout history, the rich and the aristocracy always imagined that they had skills superior to everybody else's, which is why they were in control. As far as we can tell, this wasn't true. The average duke wasn't more talented than the average peasant. He owed his superiority only to unjust legal and economic discrimination. However, by 2100, the rich might really be more talented, more creative, and more intelligent than the slum dwellers. Once a real gap in ability opens between the rich and the poor, it will become almost impossible to close it. If the rich use their superior abilities to enrich themselves further, and if more money can buy them enhanced bodies and brains, With time, the gap will only widen. By 2100, the richest 1% might own not merely most of the world's wealth, but also most of the world's beauty, creativity, and health. The two processes together, bioengineering coupled with the rise of AI, might therefore result in the separation of humankind.